Well, tonight we are looking at the fifth day of creation. I can't help but react humorously to the fact that we're taking a long time getting through 5 days of creation, like a week at a time or more. Next chart. This chart gives us a reminder, a review of the creative acts during the 6 days of creation. One, God created the light, then he had water above and below, then God made the sea and the land and the plants. Basically, he took the water, moved it, we're told in Scripture, to one area. In fact, if you look at the oceans of the world, they're actually all connected. We call this an ocean and that a sea, but they're all connected. And so, in essence, they're all pulled together and the dry land comes up and appears. And that was on the third day. On the fourth day, God made the moon, the sun, and the stars, all the celestial bodies. And that was the fourth day. And tonight we're going to look at the sea life and the birds. That's what he does on the fifth day. You think about it for a minute. How can we talk about one day so much? In reality, there's a lot of things that happen in each of the days, and a lot more stuff than we have any clue about. I've made the point in previous studies that in reality, what God did, like when he created the sun, the moon, and the stars, there was a lot of physics went into place. Engineers and astronomers refer to it as equations. And in reality, there's a lot of laws that God put in place that are never described in Genesis chapter 1. God just simply states he made the sun, he made the stars, he made the moon, right? He made all these things, but he never describes all the math that went into it, all the physics, all the different things. He just glosses it and tells us the bottom line. He just gives us the summary statement. And that's exactly the same thing that's going to happen here in day 5. So let's take a look at day 5. Earlier we read all of chapter 1 except for day 5. And so bottom line, or put another way, we read the beginning all the way through day 4. And so look at verse 20. Genesis chapter 1, verse 20 is where the fifth day starts. And we're told, and then God said, let the waters teem with swarms of living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth in the open expanse of the heavens. And God created the great sea monsters and every living creature that moves with which the waters swarmed after their kind, and every winged bird after its kind. And God saw that it was good. And God blessed them, saying, be fruitful and multiply and fill the waters in the seas, and let the birds multiply on the earth. And there was evening, and there was morning, a fifth day. So that's the creative acts of day 5. That is what we are told. And I want to look at verse 20 for a minute. And I found it rather interesting when I looked at the Hebrew text, looked at verse 20 and saw exactly what's going on here. I want you to pay attention to the word teem. It says, let the waters teem with swarms. That phrase, teem with swarms. The word teem comes from a Hebrew word that essentially means to swarm or to crowd, crawl, I should say. The idea like creeping. That's the kind of the, almost the idea. Although creeping is probably more appropriate for the land. But the basic idea is this teeming or swarming. And that's the verb form. And saras is the Hebrew word for it. And notice when it says teem with swarms. Did you know that the word swarms is the noun form of the verb teem? So from the Hebrew, the way it really reads, it goes teams teeming. Teeming the teams or swarming the swarms. Actually, just repeat is the verb form followed by the noun form. I thought it was kind of interesting. And it doesn't give us a lot of information. Other than there's stuff, watch it, there's stuff in the water that's alive. And it's moving. Let the waters, what? Teem with swarms of living creatures. The idea is that God has put living creatures in the water. Go back a chart there, if you would, Marty. It's interesting. I was thinking about the days. That's light. Here, water gets separated above and below the expanse. Here, the dry land appears, separate from the water. Here God creates the sun, the moon, and the stars. And oh, by the way, there is plants on day 3, plants. On day 5 is when you get the first animals, the first living things that are not plants. So what God creates is God creates living things to inhabit the waters. That's important. Think about that. That's what God does. He creates, and it isn't just one or two. Watch this. It isn't an amoeba that somewhere down there and crawls up on the land. God creates what? He created teams. He created swarms. He created lots of it in the waters. That's what he does. So much of it is referred to as swarms. He doesn't create one thing. Instantly, he created a whole bunch of these things. And the waters were teeming, swarming. And you say, well, swarming with what? Well, we'll talk about that in just a second. But notice what else he does. And let the birds fly above the earth. Now, the Hebrew word for birds fly, or the phrase birds fly, is again a repeat. This is op, op. It's the verb form followed by the noun form. And the word doesn't mean birds. I thought that was rather fascinating as I was looking at it. It doesn't mean birds. It means flying things. It can include insects. It can include bees. As I was thinking about bees or wasps or mosquitoes, Rachel and I had some years ago contemplated going to Alaska, the southern part of Alaska. And we were all set to go until all of a sudden somebody said, oh, by the way, did you know the mosquitoes there are like the size of bumblebees? For those of you who've been to Alaska, I understand it's not quite that bad, but God created those things. God created, watch this, not just birds. The New American Standard says birds. It shouldn't be birds. It should be flying things. And that includes the birds. It includes the insects. It includes anything and everything that flies. So watch this. God put swarms of stuff in the waters, and he put swarms of stuff in the air. What's missing? Things on the land. Day six is when all of a sudden we get all the things on the land. So on day five, God creates all the stuff swarming in the waters and all the stuff swarming in the air. And that is what God did. We have some bird feeders in our backyard. And looking at the bird feeders and seeing all these birds around, we put out some what they call sunflower seeds. Boy, do birds love sunflower seeds. They just eat them up, favorite thing. Well, God created flying things. And that's what verse 20 tells us. And when you think about the sea creatures, the things that are in the sea, that would include things like sharks and whales. That would include the seahorses, fish, eels. That would include the crabs, the sea anemones, and the flying things or cardinals. And, you know, on goes a list of all the things that God created. And he did it all. The implication here of the verse is he did it all at one time. Verse 21. By the way, I want to add that there are three unique things that happen on day five. And we'll get to that in a little bit. Because actually in verse 20, I'm passing one of them without making comments, so we're going to come back. And in verse 21, we're told, and God created the great sea monsters and every living creature that moves, with which the waters swarmed after their kind, and every winged bird after its kind. And God saw that it was good. I want to talk about the great sea monsters. God created these great, big sea monsters. And the question that obviously comes up is, well, what did he create? What are these great sea monsters? It's important to note that these are creatures that were part of the sea, but there's kind of a call out. God has pulled these out kind of like the special, and so maybe they didn't swarm the waters. We have no idea how many of them there were, but God creates these great sea monsters. I won't go there, but if you were to look at Psalm chapter 148, verse 7, you'd see that they're referred to again. If you look at Ezekiel chapter 29, verse 3, you see that they're referred to again. The message is that they keep showing up in the Old Testament. They're Old Testament creatures that the prophet Ezekiel refers to, the writer of the Psalm, that is 148, refers to, and Genesis refers to it. So what do you think about great sea monsters? You think that they're not real? Well, I think they're real. God created the stuff in the air. He created the things on the water, and he created something called great sea monsters. Now, I want to call your attention to the statement, God created. The word created here is bare. It showed up earlier in this book, in this chapter, and it showed up in verse 1. And notice in verse 1, chapter 1, verse 1, what it says. In the beginning, God, what? Created. Did you know that's the same word that shows up in verse 21? In verse 1, when we read it, we said that means God created the heavens and the earth out of what? Nothing. Ex nihilo. God created everything out of nothing. That's the implication. That is the same word that he uses in verse 21. Now, the word does not always mean ex nihilo, out of nothing. But what is very clear from the consistent usage of this word, though, is that God does the creation in a unique and new way. Now, this is important if you're an evolutionist or you're wondering about evolution, because this implies that the great sea monsters, there's no connection. They're like a brand new creation, unique, absolutely and totally unique in some kind of very different way. This is a very special creation. That's the implication. I just thought that was fascinating to think about this. God makes this thing called a great sea monster, and we're even told about it in verse 21. Now, I was thinking about all of the extinct animals when I got to this point, because the great sea monsters are extinct today. There are other animals that are extinct today as well. In fact, Marty, if you go to the next chart, one particular animal is called the dodo bird. It's extinct today. And it became extinct, we believe, in about AD 1660. A bunch of seamen regularly visited an island, I believe it was in the Atlantic, and what they did is they systematically killed all these dodo birds. They were dodo birds because they didn't know any better to run away. And the dogs and the various kinds of animals the Europeans brought to the land went off and ate all their eggs. And so the birds ended up becoming extinct. They died. Question: how many animals do you think have become extinct over the years because of mankind? How many of the original creation are extinct? We have no idea, no clue as to how many are extinct. Next chart. Or how about this guy, the Plesiosaurus? We know that he was at least 65 feet high due to the fossils we found. When did that disappear? We have no idea. Some people think that this actually is what the Loch Ness Monster is like. And that should ring a bell, I think, with most of us. But we have no idea. Is that a great sea monster? I would think yes. It would qualify. Did that really happen? Did that really occur? Well, it's kind of interesting. Did you know that there are stories around the world about great sea monsters? In China, in England, in ancient Greece, Spain, Australia, Africa, Japan, India, even in North America. In fact, it was interesting, in 1673, there were some explorers who stumbled across some caves near the Mississippi River. They saw some petroglyphs, you know, some writings on some rocks. And what they depicted was a monster, like a sea monster, next to some people. I think, personally, I think they exist. I think they existed, I should say. And I happen to also believe that the dragons were real. One of the reasons I believe that they were real is look at Job chapter 41. Job 41 actually describes one. In Job 41, God makes the following interesting comment. He says, "Can you draw out Leviathan with a fish hook or press down his tongue with a cord? And can you put a rope in his nose or pierce his jaw with a hook?" Look at verse 7. Can you fill his skin with harpoons or his head with fishing spears? That implies that he was in the water. Verse 12 says, I will not keep silent concerning his limbs or his mighty strength or his orderly frame. Who can strip off his outer armor? And who can come with his double mail? And who can open the doors of his face? Around his teeth there is terror, and his strong scales are his pride, shut up as with a tight seal. One is so near to another that no air can come between them. They are joined one to another, and they clasp each other and cannot be separated. He sneezes forth light, and his eyes are like the eyelids of the morning, and out of his mouth go burning torches, sparks of fire leap forth, and out of his nostrils smoke goes forth, and as from a boiling pot and burning rushes, and his breath kindles coals, and a flame goes forth from his mouth, and in his neck lodges strength, and dismay leaps before him. The folds of his flesh are joined together, firm on him and immovable, and his heart is as hard as a stone, even as a lower millstone. And when he raises himself up with mighty fear because of the crashing, they will be bewildered. And the sword that reaches him cannot avail, nor the spear, the dart, or the javelin. He regards iron as straw, bronze as rotten wood. The arrow cannot make him flee. Sling stones are turned into stubble for him, and clubs are regarded as stubble, and he laughs at the rattling of the javelin. His underparts are like sharp potsherds, and his spears he spreads out like a threshing sled on the mire, and he makes the depths boil like a pot, and he makes the sea like a jar of ointment. Behind him he makes a wake to shine. One would think that the deep to be gray-haired, nothing on earth is like him. One made without fear, and he looks on everything that is high. He is king over the sons of pride. What a fascinating, fascinating description. One of the things we're planning on doing in the coming weeks is have a video that chronicles the legends around the world of Leviathan. They don't call it Leviathan, we call it Leviathan. And the dinosaurs actually are the dragons. Actually exist if you go through and you look at the stories around the world. We call them myths, we call them legends. But I have to ask a question. If they didn't exist, and it's just the result of mythology, why is it in so many countries around the world? If it didn't exist, why is it repeated in country after country after country after country? And why has it come from ancient times? I think the reason it comes from ancient times around the globe is that they did exist. And it's us today who think we're so smart that these things could not exist. In fact, there are even insects today that actually do spit forth fire. Now, that might surprise some people that that really even happens today. God can, watch this, make anything he wants to make. He can do anything he wants to do. Modern scientist folklore. Well, I don't know that that's just folklore. I don't think, in fact, that is actually true. So what God has done here in Genesis chapter 20 and 21, as we're told, is that God made the things that swarm in the waters. He makes the things that swarm in the air. And oh, by the way, he made great sea monsters. And one of the unique things in this verse is that it's very clear that the sea monster has no connection to anything else in the creation. And did you also notice here in verse 21 is that the things that swarm in the waters are going to reproduce after what? Their kind. And the things that swarm in the air are going to reproduce what? After their kind. There's not going to be an evolutionary process. It's kind after kind after kind, flesh after flesh after flesh, same flesh. Verse 22, and God blessed them, saying, be fruitful and multiply and fill the waters in the seas and let the birds multiply on the earth. Now, I said that there are three unique things to this passage, three unique things that don't show up before you get to day five. And the first thing that's unique is in verse 20. It talks about living creatures. The word for living here is nephesh. Actually, it's a word that is used sometimes to refer to the soul of a man. We're not trying to imply, however, that animals have souls, but the point is that they are living. These are living creatures. These are brand new. The second thing that's important to notice here is that in verse 22, there's the word blessed. It's the first time the word blessed shows up in the account of Genesis. And then I've already mentioned the other thing, and that is the word created shows up again here in verse 21 versus verse 1. So three very different things that show up here in day 5. Now I want to shift gears a little bit, and I want to talk about evolution. And I want to talk about some evolutionary evidences and some things hopefully that have some meaning to each of us as believers and really kind of coming out of day 5. The fact that God created these different animals, be it sea or be it creatures in the air, there is one of them that I want to talk about. It's called the hermit crab. The hermit crab is a very unique creature. And we have one up there on the screen up on the upper left. What a hermit crab does is it actually goes and takes a shell and it makes it its home. And I have a little section here that I would like to read to you about the hermit crab. And I think that's probably the best way to communicate the thought rather than me trying to digest it and then repeat it to you. It says, then there's the hermit crab. Unlike other crabs, hermit crabs have no outer shell of their own. Their abdomen is soft, and they would be easy prey for predators if they did not have a means of protection. So what do? They borrow used shells from various gastropods. They always use empty shells, never killing the live occupants. And they will migrate from shell to shell as they outgrow their homes. In other words, as they get bigger, they just move from one shell to another shell. Crab's body is naturally twisted to fit perfectly into the host shell. The crab's legs are perfectly designed for this habitat. It uses only the two legs immediately behind its claws for walking. The other legs grip the borrowed shell and hang on to it. The crab's enlarged right claw serves as a door to cover the shell's opening when the crab retreats inside. These crabs have a symbiotic relationship with sea anemones. Sea anemones have stinging shells that repel most other creatures, but hermit crabs often form partnerships with anemones and carry them around on their shells, with the same enemy switching with a switch to a new host shell when the crab migrates. In other words, a sea anemone just follows a hermit crab from shell to shell to shell, and that's the basic idea. The anemone feeds off the leftovers from the crab's meals, and the crab is protected from predators by the anemone. So hermit crab, he eats, he doesn't finish the job, the anemone comes and eats the leftovers, and at the same time the anemone protects the hermit crab. Could the crab and the anemone have evolved these features? Certainly not. The loss of its own protective shell would be contrary to evolution's principle of the survival of the fittest. And the evolution of a body so perfectly suited to the borrowed shell of another creature is impossible to explain by evolutionary principles. The hermit crab is simply more evidence of an intelligent creator. I thought that was pretty cool. And God has made them rather unique. There's another creature I want to talk about. It's called the red cockeyed woodpecker. I'll read a little bit about him as well. The red cockeyed woodpecker has four strong toes that enable it to cling firmly to the sides of trees. It uses its long, sharp beak to chisel holes in long-leaf pine trees and builds its nest in holes that it has chiseled out of the living trees. A single bird might spend 3 years excavating a home. That's a long time. The woodpecker's primary predator is the rat snake. Rat snakes can climb trees. So as a protective measure, the woodpecker drills small holes above and below its nest hole. Resin seeps from the small holes and oozes down the side of the tree. And when the rat snake comes in contact with the resin, its scales get gummy and the snake is unable to climb the tree. In order to keep the sap flowing, the woodpecker must maintain the resin holes on a daily basis. The bird's presence is helpful, not hurtful to the tree, because it feeds on insects and carpenter ants, which destroy the trees. Now, you think about this from an evolutionary viewpoint for a minute. Think about this. what happened to the woodpeckers, if you assume an evolutionary concept, when did the woodpeckers finally figure out to poke these little holes so that sap would run so that the snake wouldn't come up and eat them? I wonder how many woodpeckers got eaten by rat snakes before they finally figured out that they had to do this. Kind of difficult to think about that. Plus, then you need two of them to reproduce, right? Just interesting to think about this whole process of how all this stuff works. The idea of evolution, of evolutionary involvement, when you look at some of the very specifics, is kind of difficult. Or how about considering this? Did you realize that all of the males and female animals around the globe usually have, the males have XY chromosomes and the females have what? XX. Males determine the sex of the offspring. But did you know that the bird chromosomes are exactly the flip? The men have the XX and the females have the XY. Now, how did that happen if you buy into an evolutionary process? How did that occur? Or how about bird migration? Birds who migrate. Got another interesting little article about birds and migration. Listen to this. Bird migration is another amazing example of the Creator's infinite wisdom. Many birds migrate long distances each year with uncertain precision, uncanny precision. Arctic terns hold the record for the longest migration. They travel from the North Pole to the South Pole and back again each year. Most birds that migrate long distances fly mostly at night. They do this because one of the main ways they navigate is by the stars. Studies have shown that even birds raised entirely indoors can orient themselves properly the first time they see the stars. Tests done in planetariums show that birds know which direction to fly even in artificial skies if the stars are properly placed. But when the star alignment in the planetarium is confused, the birds are confused as well. Now, how did the birds acquire this capability before they died? Fascinating to think about it. What does it argue for? Argues for a creator who created them to be that way as opposed to evolving the capability. Just really fascinating to think about what God did on day five. God didn't watch us just make swarms in the waters and swarms in the air. He gave them capabilities. He gave them abilities. God did some really terrific things. I want to talk about dating now for a second. Next chart. And the question is, how old is the earth? I was trying to debate as to when to do this, and I thought I'd hold it for day five. We've been talking about rocks and water and animals, and I thought I'd take a little venture and deal with dating issues here tonight. And I want to start off with simple illustration. Next chart. This is probably a good way to try to get into the subject. It gets a little complicated, so I'm going to try to stay surfacey, summary level, as opposed to getting into a bunch of details. But basically what scientists do when they try to figure out how old something is that they take a rock and they analyze the rock. And what they're looking for is they're looking for different kinds of radioactive isotopes. And radioactive isotopes have half-lives. That is that they, after a half-life, they spin off what they call daughter atoms. They actually create a different kind of an atom. And so that's what I have up here, parent atoms and then daughter atoms. All it means is that this atom came from that atom after a half-life. It spun off. In other words, it turns into another chemical after some time. And so that's basically what we're talking about, parent atoms and daughter atoms. And this, by the way, this process happens over time. As time goes by, there's more and more daughter atoms. Boy, we're using an hourglass. The parent atoms turn into daughter atoms, so there's a process that's occurring, and they're able to estimate how old certain things are. Next chart. There's some key assumptions that go into this process. One of the key ones, first of all, is that they assumed that all the atoms were parent atoms and that there weren't any daughter atoms. There wasn't anything to transition. They also assumed that they understand the transition rate, that is how fast parent atoms turn into daughter atoms. They understand the initial conditions, how much was parent atoms and how much was daughter atoms. They also assume that there's no contamination in the process, that is, they didn't get atoms from some other source. And they also assume that they understand the decay rate, how this thing is happening. Well, interestingly enough, they took some rocks from Mount St. Helens. You remember back in 1986 that Mount St. Helens blew? Remember that? And it spewed lava all over the place and dust. Well, Rachel had a brother-in-law, and I'll never forget the day that he visited us on one occasion and handed me a jar of a bunch of gray stuff. It was ash from Mount St. Helens. I had a whole jar of ash from Mount St. Helens. Well, I don't have it today. I wish I had it because I've come to find out it's rather expensive if you wanted to get some. But anyway, I actually had some from this mountain. Well, what scientists have done, they waited about 5-10 years and they took a rock sample from the lava. And they went and they dated it. Double check on their dating process. What they found is that the rocks that got formed supposedly are 350,000 years old. They measured argon-40, the daughter atom, in excess of what it should have been. Well, that told them that they had some major problems. Well, question. How many evolutionists advertise that? They don't advertise that they had a major problem dating the lava rock that came out of Mount St. Helens. There's another mountain down in New Zealand. I'm not quite sure how to pronounce it. I'm not sure how to pronounce that. But they acquired some lava rock as well. That's 50 years old. They dated it as well. They found an excess of argon-40, and they came up with a date of 3.5 million years, when it only should have been 50 years. You know what that tells you about the dating processes that are being used by our scientists to date how old our world is? They have major problems. Why? They really do not know the initial conditions. That is, they don't know how many parent atoms there were and how many daughter atoms there are. And oh, by the way, remember the daughter atoms are formed as time goes by. There's more and more and more of these. What happens is that the parent atoms decay and they turn into a different kind of a chemical, or they turn into helium, and they're able to measure parent atoms versus daughter atoms that are in the rock. They can then see, well, they have so many daughter atoms, and they're assuming that they know the decay rate, so then they're able to figure what? Time. All based on assumption. So if the assumption is wrong, you get what? 3.5 million years versus what? 50 years. What they also did is that they dated it different ways. Here's some other dates. If you go to rubidium strontium, you get 13.3 million years. You go to cerium, it's 197 million years. You get uranium lead, 3.9 billion years. There are a large number of different dating processes that are used. Trying to find a table that showed all the different processes. When we were back at Answers in Genesis, they actually showed us a chart. It was a fascinating chart. Did you know that 80% of all of the dating processes that are used argue for a world is created in less than 10,000 years? And there's only basically 4 techniques that are used to date the age of rocks today. And all of the 4 that they use give you dates like this. Millions of years and billions of years, but 80% of the processes that they use, they just ignore because it gives you dates of the Earth less than 10,000 years. Now, I call that an integrity problem. You throw out the stuff that doesn't support your theory, and you use the things that do support your theory. Next one. This is a very interesting chart. Same rocks come from the Grand Canyon. They took the same rocks, and they took parts of the rock, and they put it through different test processes. Look at the variation in the dates. The same rocks. Not different rocks, but the same rock. So obviously, it's possible you got different rocks, you get different dates, but if you take the same rock and you put it through different dating processes, you should get the same dates, right? Well, if you get roughly 516 million versus almost a billion years, that tells you that there are some major problems in the different dating processes that are being used. So what does all this argue for? Well, we can't say evolutionists are using some tools that aren't valuable. The conclusion we can come to is that there's a lot of reason to not believe millions and billions of years. I have a chart at home where secularists around the world, in China, India, Middle East, predicted how old the world is or the Earth is. And the oldest date that they have from any of the secular writers is roughly 6,000 years old, except for one guy. There's a gentleman, you can look it up on the internet, his name is Manetho. He was in Egypt. What he did is he took the order of the pharaohs in Egypt. And, of course, one pharaoh was followed by another pharaoh. It was one kingdom after another. What Manetho did, he was actually a priest in Egypt, is he lists all the pharaohs. And if you take the pharaohs and you go back in time, it gives you roughly a date of 10,000 years for the world. If you put all the information together, it really argues for an Earth that is not millions and billions of years old, but a very young Earth. Is it 4,000? Is it 6,000? Is it 10,000? I'm not sure we know that for sure, but I don't believe the world is millions and billions of years old, and the evolutionists have a major, major problem. Let's pray.